CastorBellows.com has to be my favorite website in the cosmos. Would you like a jelly belly?
I cross the void beyond the mind, the empty space that circles time. I see where others stumble blind to seek a truth they never find. Eternal wisdom is my God.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a podcast with a K, with me, Brian Turnover, and him, Christian Corley.
Neither with K's.
Neither with K's, yeah. Slight identity crisis there, as you can no doubt tell. I'm Christian, he's Brian. How are you? I'm well.
Good. Yeah,
yeah, you're well. I was talking to the listener. How are you, listener? Oh, sorry to hear that. No, listen, how did that song not get to number one?
Sorry, you still talking to the listener?
No, I'm talking to you now.
Oh, to me. Oh.
Hey, Brian! How did that song not get to number one?
How indeed?
Has it got one of the great, best openings of any song ever?
Yeah.
It just goes and goes, and then it builds, and then it, just where you think it's going to start, it then swings it round a little bit and does it some more. I love that. I really do love it. Went a little bit retro there, dear listener, on the intro there, because we used our Tom Baker from the old BT SMS thing from a few years ago, British Telecom here in the UK. You could call, you could text the service, and then a computer-generated sentence voiced by Tom Baker would pop up. To the person that you send it to. So I sent a few of them to my landline and recorded them. Followed that was the that was Delta and the Bannermen outside. Hello. Following that was I Am the Doctor by John Pertwee. Now there's two reasons for playing that. One, we used it on the podcast in the old days when it was just me and Brian. So if you've ever listened to podcast season one, there's about, I think there's eight of them, isn't there?
Yeah, I think that's about it.
Yeah, seven or eight. They're on YouTube, or some of them are on YouTube. So you can pick them up there on our Castover's TV channel. And we used that tune a few times on there. And the other reason I've used it is because this weekend, in July, in the next 7 days, so by the time we've done this podcast and you get the next podcast, it'll be a bit late. So I thought we'd talk about it now. The 7th of July is John Pertwee's birthday. I'm mentioning this for no other reason than the fact that, because we normally don't do birthdays and things, and you know, it's not like 100 years, because it would be 1919, but John Pertwee, strangely, he was born in 1919, strangely for me, he was born in 1919. As we found out a few months ago, he had this crazy kind of wartime espionage career, and then he died, that he never really talked about, and most people didn't know about. And then he died in 1996. Now, strangely, my granddad was born in 1919, in September, October time. And he also died in 1996. And he was also fought in World War II. Although, as far as I know, he wasn't a spy, but we don't really know what he did. So that's the main reason why I bring this up, just because of that interesting coincidence. And because we don't really know what they did. Now, another person who we don't really know what they do is James McLean. Now, he's not here this time, so it's just Brian and I.
Nice.
And we're going to be talking about a few things. So it's I would have liked to have James here, because we do have a few things that we'd like to talk about. But just going back to John Pertwee. Now, I've got this little audio clip to play. This is Wink Taylor, the voice artist, as John Pertwee, as Doctor Who.
Come over here and look what I've just discovered. It would appear to be an audio recording. I'm just hoping this isn't some sort of knavish scheme cooked up by the Master. Tell the Brigadier I'm not to be disturbed, and there goes double for Mike Yates and especially Sergeant Benton. There appears to be some kind of message encrypted deep within this audio recording. If I reverse the polarity of the neutron flow of my sonic screwdriver, then we should be able to interpret the message. Here goes. Eureka!
It's a bit longer than that, the full thing. I notice, I quite like Wink Taylor's portrayal of John Pertwee there. I love his Eureka as well. There just seem to be an awful lot more Doctor Who voice artists and Doctor Who impersonators turning up.
Yeah, it does seem like they're popping out of the woodworks lately. I suppose, I mean, as the show becomes more and more popular and demand for it, especially since Big Finish is starting to use them, is there. It's just going to be a thing.
Probably is, yeah. I remember, I think when we spoke to John Guiler many, many moons ago, that he was kind of, wasn't particularly something he sought after doing, though. So maybe that opens the door for other people, I don't know. And, I mean, certainly John Culshaw's done a bit, hasn't he? And he's kind of, I mean, really, although he was doing voices in the UK, he was doing, like, radio shows as Tony Blair and things like that. And Chris Tarrant doing Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And a few other voices, but he really, his main thing was doing Tom Baker. That's the thing that really made him famous, doing an impersonation of Tom Baker. Or an impersonation of the Fourth Doctor, or an approximation of the Fourth Doctor. It was certainly more of a caricature than other voice artists may have done. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing. Now, speaking of voice artists, Big Finish uses a lot of voice artists, doesn't it?
Well, you mean impersonators or just voice artists, period?
Just voice artists, yes. Actors and
yes,
voice artists.
Yes, they do.
Yeah. It's kind of their bread and butter,
that's
really,
kind
isn't
of
it?
Their thing. Yeah.
Their thing, yeah.
Kind of necessary for the work.
Yes, one would certainly think so, yes. We'll come back to that later. So Doom Coalition 2 has been announced, hasn't it?
What is that?
Doom Coalition 2, that's a new Doctor Who adventure for the Eighth Doctor.
Oh, that thing, yes, okay.
Yeah.
Forgot the name of it.
Yeah, in which he's going to be helped out by Livchenka, Nicola Walker, and Helen Sinclair, Hattie Morahan, and a certain... Do you want to say it?
Or no. Shall I?
And a certain River Song. Now, sweetie, we don't have any spoilers in this, so don't worry. Big Finish has announced a new range of box sets featuring River Song, Winston Churchill, and perhaps, probably more exciting, really, long-term, new monsters. Do you want to start with the new monsters?
Go for it.
Okay, because we've got Big Finish say the 5th, 6th, 7th and 8th Doctors will face a new generation of monsters in Doctor Who, Classic Doctors, New Monsters. A brand new four-story run featuring creatures from the new series. Peter Davison takes on the Weeping Angels. Colin Baker encounters the Jadoon. Sylvester McCoy will meet the Sycorax. And Paul McGann will face a new clone batch of Sontarans on the edge of the Time War, which sounds particularly exciting. Just clarify for me here. This is the most interesting part of the whole thing, isn't it?
That they're all meeting new monsters?
Yeah.
Meh, sure.
You don't think?
No, really.
You don't think that's more interesting than Churchill or River Song?
I think anything's more interesting than that, but I don't really think that I'm particularly interested in them meeting the new monsters. I like the fact that the Eighth Doctor is going to meet the Sontarans, because hopefully they will do something good with them, but that's a small hope, because nobody's really done something good with them for, God, at least 5 years.
And go for that, they're going to say 40.
No. Well, Big Finish did a couple fair stories, and then when Strax was kind of created, they did the same thing, and they turned their Big Finish Sontarans into kind of jokes. Not in every story, but for the most part, they did the same kind of thing, and it just kind of dulled the characters down. It made the stories uninteresting. I'm not trying to be rude here, but that, you know, it's tough to get into a story where the villains are kind of bumbling idiots, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what you mean, totally, yeah. Well, you know, this is an interesting idea I've got, just to diverge from this slightly for a moment. I've got this idea, I don't know how you did that, Brian, but excellent, congratulations on your multitasking. Sending me an email from Titan.
Oh. Sent that ages ago, you just got
It's just popped up, yeah. This idea, I think we maybe mentioned it once or twice on the podcast as well, and it's beginning to trouble me more and more, how Doctor Who, since 2005, focuses on the Doctor and the Companion. Okay. Pre-2005, and I include the TV movie in this, Doctor Who focused on, at least equally, but in some kinds, some often was quite obsessed by, focused on the villains. So it was as much the villains and the monsters show as it was the Doctors. These days, you never find out, unless it's the Master, you never get scenes of the villains. Oh, perhaps the Daleks occasionally, but now I think about it. Yeah, just once or twice. You very, very rarely get scenes of the villains operating on their own.
Oh, right. Okay, I see what you're saying.
You see what I mean? So, you know, you don't get a Harrison Chase, because even if there was time for a Harrison Chase, the focus wouldn't be on the villain, it would be on the Doctor and the Companion.
Right.
Love and Monsters is another example where, well, that's a Doctor Light episode anyway. And Victor Kennedy, what he's doing kind of drives what Linda are doing. And then, you know, so that's, we can discount that. But, you know, we've got, you know, you've got, when it's proper arch villains like Lumich and Davros, then you do see what the villains are up to. But it's very, very rare. Which is one of the reasons, I think, why, going back to River Song, why Stephen Moffat used River Song, I think. Because it allows him to, in whatever way, I'm not judging this in either direction, but it allowed him an opportunity to develop a story without the Doctor being present, but with a regular, compelling, in inverted, in quotes, character. You know, we don't get Harrison Chases anymore. We don't get Sharis Jecks. We don't get, you know, that type of character. Give me another one. Throw another one at me. A pirate captain. We don't get these larger-than-life villains. We don't get Mahendri Solons in Doctor Who anymore, because those roles aren't really there.
And Skagoroth.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Skagoroth into Jagoroth, yeah.
That's it.
So, yeah, there needs to be. Doctor Who needs to get back to making the villains the big, giving them plenty to do, the villains.
They need to make them essentially be the threat.
Yeah, totally.
They need to, rather than just have them be this thing that pops up that we're supposed to be afraid of just because they look maybe scary, or
like the
what
power
they're
of
doing
three.
Is scary.
Like the power of three.
Exactly. I mean, we need to see motives. We need to see some interest behind them, you know, and I don't know, even just something that is a break from the main characters, to be honest, because they seem to get a little bit stale if all we do is focus on them having fun at the danger and nothing else really major going on.
Yeah, so basically, when Doctor Who, or classic Doctor Who, including the TV movie, seems to be about the villains and the monsters, whereas nowadays it's about the Doctor and his companions. And I don't think that's right. I think it's an interesting take on it, but doing it for 10 years... And I think that's where the problem is with Doctor Who. I think that it isn't necessarily who's running the show. It's this whole take on Doctor Who since 2005 that needs refreshing. So perhaps the new showrunner will readjust that and refocus on the villains whenever that time comes, whenever that happens. But anyway, going back to Big Finish and what they're doing. We've got the classic Doctor. I like the idea of... bumping into the Jadoon. I like the Sycorax.
Yes.
There isn't really anything in the Christmas Invasion that suggests that the Doctor has or hasn't seen the Sycorax before.
Well, yeah, okay. Admittedly, I'd like to see the Sycorax again, but this is one of those things where I definitely would have liked to have seen in the new series rather than go to the Big Finish audios, because that suggests to me, to be perfectly honest, that they don't see any merit of the Sycorax being in the show again.
Hmm.
All they're looking at is okay, well, people... want these things, but you know, that'll be good for audio because they're just okay, you know. But I think there's a lot of weight that they can put behind them and make them very interesting.
Well, the Sycorax could have been a modern day Draconians, couldn't they? Well, they have been, really, because they've only been in it once.
Yeah, but they could have even been more than that, considering, well, I mean, you could have done a lot with them, because they did seem like they were either a people that, you know, could be the bad guy, or like you said, with the Draconians, you essentially could use them as allies, and it might be another interesting take on another race outside humans who have both good and evil, you know, in their species.
Yeah. No, I couldn't agree more with that. I kind of like the idea of Peter Davison with the Weeping Angels. I don't know how you do the Weeping Angels on radio, though.
Partly the issue there. Yeah. honestly... I think the Weeping Angels have had their day. I think with each successive story that they've had, they've gotten more boring because the idea, the concept, that made them so great in the first place just gets changed and used and wasted kind of thing. And I can't, I mean, in audio, when they first started doing the audios, a lot of the descriptive dialogue really kind of gave the game away a lot, that you were listening to an audio. And of course, you know, you're listening to an audio, but the point is that you're just supposed to be listening and get immersed in an adventure without really sitting there every 5 seconds realizing, well, that's right, there's no pictures here. You know, I can listen to a good one on a drive or in my home and just completely see the adventure and enjoy the hell out of it. But in the beginning, you would get certain things like, oh my God, doctor, there's a big green monster with two eyes and three heads over there. What do we do? And it's like, you wouldn't get that in the show. You know, you could in certain ways, and they became aware of this later on, that you could use descriptive dialogue exactly how it could be used in a TV show. And some things you still had to cross the line. But with the Weeping Angels, what are you going to do? There's a statue over there. I swear it moved. Well, it couldn't have moved. It's just a statue. How then do you convey that the statue moved except for people's dialogue? And I don't know. Maybe it could work, because technically, I guess they still did the same thing in the episode, but it's a bit more scary and creepy when you can see the statue move without the characters realizing the statue move.
There's definitely got to be something more to tell us about that particular thing there.
Yeah.
One would suggest. But look, we'll not get too well tied up with that. But I do want to say, I do think that as much as I'm, and I know, Brian, you're utterly nonplussed by River Song turning up. And she's got her own thing as well. She's got the Diary of River Song, an epic four-hour adventure that takes River across space and time, seeking out the secret rulers of the universe, which will also feature the Eighth Doctor in the final installment. I do think that Big Finish have got an opportunity here to do a Sixth Doctor on River Song.
Why?
In terms of giving her a lease of life beyond television to perhaps.
Oh, I see. Have her meet the Sixth Doctor. You mean what Big Finish did for the Sixth Doctor?
For the Sixth Doctor, yeah.
Well, you know, in fairness, when you said that they were giving her own story, I was on board when you said it. I was like, you know, that's kind of cool. That's good. That's what they should have done. And then when you said the Eighth Doctor is popping in at the end, that's when they lost me. You know, they should do interesting things, because people are very curious what River Song did in many of those years that she was out there prior, from her basically her conception to her death. And I think
you can't say
thing.
That because I'm not.
Whoa!
Oh, hello. Hi, welcome James McLean to the podcast. This is where we should have a round of applause. This is the Happy Days round of applause moment.
No, it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be on two grounds. I could have been here all the time listening. Listening, naked, wondering, or if I had just turned up to find out you're talking about that River Song thing, and I don't know, I couldn't think of a worse article to slip my face into.
So how much have you heard?
If I've been here all the time, I've been
heard
listening
it,
to
obviously.
Other things. You would think, but it wasn't about me, and I find it very hard to keep up with things which aren't about me. Sorry, yeah. Brian, you were saying.
No, I was basically just saying that, you know, a River Song series solely with River Song and her own adventures, and maybe if they can somehow work in like Matt Smith era people. I know people who would be interested in that, not myself, and I know not James. Bringing her into the Eighth Doctor's era, even by their own description of, you know, she has to do it all without the Eighth Doctor even knowing she's there or meeting him. It's kind of like, then why do it? Why bother? Like, you know, I agree with Matt Smith when he says that he loves how River Song is kind of wrapped up in a bow with David Tennant and Matt Smith's Doctor, and he wants it to stay that way. He's even asked Stephen Moffat not to use her again in the new series, because that was his thing, you know, his character, his wife in the show. And I agree with that, and I think it works better that way. And I think even River, the more that you make her go in the past and see all the different Doctors, you're turning her into that Clara character who just went back all through history and saved every one of the Doctors, and everything that we've ever known that happened was probably because of Clara, or now River. I think it would be so much cooler if River just thought she was this awesome thing, or rather not thought, but portrayed that, came off that way to try and sell people that she was this really cool big deal, when really she didn't know as much and she wanted to know as much, but never got there because her life got cut short. You know, maybe she had plans to do these things, but she only met 10 and 11. And, you know, I when the news came out, I had friends that were excited and I had friends who were not. And I had others who were just saying, you know, trying to justify her appearance there and so on. And to me, it's just kind of like, man, you guys get some new big Finnish licenses and this is what you do with it. Like, Paul McGann doesn't need help in his plays. His plays are like the main thing that I still continue to collect from them, because he is the selling factor and the stories for him is a selling factor. You don't need River Song as a gimmick. And I feel that's all it is.
Mm-hmm. Could it be argued that that's purely what River Song is?
Well, clearly she is.
For just generally speaking, across...
I would,
you know,
say so, yeah.
Yeah, okay. James, are you still with us?
So. Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, good.
I don't know why, actually, but I'm still here.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, we love talking to you too.
It's not you, it's... to be honest, with the River Song thing, I don't mind. I mean, I think I find it vaguely irritating when it's pushed in my face in a story that I cannot decide whether I watch or not, in a weird way. If they want to indulge in her in audio adaptations, which are ones that you buy or you don't, that's cool. I have no particular issue is to say, oh my God, I don't want any more River Song. It seems a bit cruel to say I don't want any more River Song episodes, which I don't have to go and buy. Mm-hmm. You've got to appreciate that some people really love the character and think she's great and love the idea as you know, of seeing how she would integrate with other characters. But it's not for me. I think it's kind of cool. The Churchill thing's cool. And I like the fact they've got the license now to sort of start playing around with the two eras of the franchise. I think that's good. I must admit, yeah, River Song is. I mean, in a sense, I suppose if it wasn't for the fact that it by its very initiation, it is difficult to have River Song in a story with another Doctor. It sort of kills the thrust of enjoying it. If you were interested in seeing how that dynamic would play out, because the dynamic really can't. Not well, it can because it's fiction and you can do whatever you want. But in a sort of weird way, it can't, because it's already set that it can't. I don't know.
Well, you know, there's a heavy element to Silence in the Library and Forest of the Dead that they've never met, as far as the Doctor's concerned.
Yeah.
So, how meeting her, how encountering her twice, two lives previously.
Well, that's it. I mean, you can do it, but you'll end up having to find ways to fudge in the fact that he doesn't remember her.
Yeah.
Which in itself becomes unsatisfying. Wipe. Yeah.
Yeah, time transfers or time changes, alterations or whatever, all sorts of things. Or, like I said, which was their premise, that she has to do everything without meeting the Doctor. So more than likely, most of her scenes would be with Livchenka, you know, but...
Which becomes unsatisfying as an audience, because you feel that construct. Unless you do something sort of fairly ballsy and sort of have the Eighth Doctor say, because he knows that he's not meant to know her, he will somehow erase or just retain the memory of her within that incarnation and do something a little different. I mean, but even there, you are still having to adapt. But I suppose that is the whole nature of Big Finish, isn't it? You're often inserting stories which shouldn't be there into spaces because you want them to be there. And you're finding reasons to do it. And
she could always be using a nom de plume anyway.
Yeah, but even if you did that, you'd have to have them meet like minimally. You couldn't really make them have like long scenes together, because he'd remember her more than likely. I mean, granted, he can forget her. I understand that. But I don't know. But what you just said, though, James, was exactly what I thought. Like, Big Finish was best when they found ways to insert stories in between other stories, find placeholders where they could tell more adventures and make them make sense and so on. So when they got this new series license, I kind of thought, or whatever kind of license they have to these new series characters, I personally would have rather have seen or heard more adventures for like the 10th or the 11th Doctors. And I know we won't get Chris, but the one thing that I always said I wanted to see was what happened in between The Doctor Dances and Boomtown, because they had tons of adventures, the three of them. And you know, a lot of people are always throwing out there when you're talking who's a proper companion, which are just ridiculous debates on the internet anymore. But I see too many people saying that Jack isn't, because he only had like three adventures. And it's like, did you miss the part where like they had tons of adventures and they became time TARDIS? Yeah.
Welcome to this week's Kesterverse podcast with a K.
Do carry
what
on,
was sorry. That?
That was a mad PC thing going on.
Well, I think my point is done now.
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right.
Podcast thing doesn't like it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think
there's an opportunity for the Ninth Doctor, you know, because we've obviously got Torchwood coming back. There's an opportunity for some, you know, companion chronicle style Ninth Doctor stories in the almost certain unavailability of Christopher Eccleston.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, obviously, I don't think he'll do them. It would be nice if someone could sweet talk him into doing it, but when I first heard that they were doing Torchwood, I thought, oh, cool, you know, there's plenty of things
audio podcast with a K.
No, all right, you know what? I'm
God's sake, damn you!
I just wanted to try it. Sorry, Brad.
Because James doesn't like me talking, either the real James or Computer James.
Shall we move on?
I am now leaving.
Shall we move on? We've just passed. It's another anniversary thing. James, you missed us talking about John Pertwee earlier, but this you will prefer. I don't want to do too much of this because it's quite a long clip. So I'm going to just... What it is James may well know this. You may well spotted this on Kesterverse, that it's 50 years since Ian and Barbara left. In the chase. Let's pick it up here. This is just Ian stepping out of where they've landed in the Dalek time machine. And he looks across and sees a subway, London Underground station. Looks at the car, sees it's December 1965. Well, that's when its disc expires.
London 1965.
Hey, we're 2 years out.
Oh, what's 2 years amongst friends? We're home. I'm just going to press that button. Run!
Well, let's put paid to the Daleks time traveling for a while.
Give the Doctor a breather anyway.
Yes. I wonder where he is right now.
Hey, Doctor, wherever you are...
Shh! Someone coming.
Goodbye, Doctor. Thanks for the ride.
It was fun, Doctor. Goodbye.
And there commences a photo montage of Ian and Barbara back in London. 50 years... sorry, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, I like how they inadvertently, because it obviously wasn't intentional particularly, they say, no, it's 1965, so it's obviously been like 2 years out. But they don't suggest that they've been away for 2 years. You could have as many adventures as you like, really, in that period.
Mm.
So they could have been away for 5-6 years with the Doctor and the TARDIS and then got back in 1965, which it almost sounds like it's meant to infer that the date isn't relative to the amount of time they've been away.
But it could be an expired disc as well. It could be 1970.
It could be, absolutely. That would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. Things weren't necessarily as stringent with tax discs in those days as they are today, where you pay online and don't even have a disc.
It could have been a misprint, and it was 1963. November the 23rd.
Yes.
They're going to go back and they're going to say, hey, look, everyone, I'm sorry it's 1965. You know, we've been away and do this long, elaborate story. And they'll go, what? You were here yesterday. There's no problem. Or you were here the day before. It's March 1963. And then their other two versions will come in and they will look and they'll be all shocked. And then Ian will accidentally touch the other Ian and there'll be an explosion. They'll turn around and everyone is wearing an eye patch.
Eye patch,
you know.
Yeah. Indeed. Actually, it got me thinking, though, how much those 2 years since 2013 have gone. And 2 years ago, we were... I'm paraphrasing here. I've absolutely checked it up, so I'm talking kind of roughly. We were waiting for the 50th anniversary. We were just kind of getting over the War Doctor, and then in a few weeks' time there would be a trailer at the SDCC, which would really piss us off because we wouldn't get a trailer for the 50th anniversary for like another 2 months or so. You know, and that was just 2 years ago. And here we are with another quite significant in terms of Doctor Who's developing story, and but both in front of and behind the scenes, in front of the camera and behind the camera. And here we've got this. So, that's why I wanted to mention it, because it just seems to have come along quite quickly, really, I thought. I wish they'd stop doing that. Sorry, my neighbours keep going in and out, and it's really inconsiderate of them.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously they don't know that we do a podcast, so I shouldn't really be too cruel to them. Hi, neighbours. I'm sure they don't listen.
Well, no, they won't. If they don't know we do a podcast, they're not exactly going to be listening.
That's why I'm sure.
That would be quite crazy.
Yeah,
that would be Spike Milligan crazy, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure about that.
Not Marty Feldman crazy, but it's like...
Okay. I honestly haven't watched either of them for a very long time.
That's because they're both dead, so you can't really watch them.
Well, you
I suppose you could on television.
Television, yeah.
Yeah,
I wasn't talking. Yeah. You know, I wasn't talking about stalking them or anything like that, because that would be weird. Yeah. Don't know how we got into that, but what did you do, guys, get up to at the weekend? Did you do anything Whovian at the weekend?
Nope.
Okay. And James?
No.
No. Okay. Well, that's okay. The reason I asked.
And this is one of those weird and quirky things which you could probably, aside from the aircraft, you done?
Yeah. Where are you? Are you at an airfield?
Apparently I am. Or maybe I'm an airfield passing an aircraft. It's a new idea that the aircraft stays stationary and the airfield makes its way to the aircraft. As long as they're both...
That does kind of happen in a way.
It kind
slower.
Of does. Anyway, what I was going to say, it's not this weekend, and I wouldn't remember any other time. I may or may not had problems sleeping recently, and may or may not have just been asleep and then woke up randomly and then realized the podcast was running.
Right.
Sort of
right.
thing students sometimes do, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And I just remembered in the dream I was having... It was a Doctor Who anniversary. There'd been a police box that was nearby that had been erected, and I'd taken it in my car, brought it home, and put it in the field behind my house. And then at some point in the dream, got very, very concerned of the fact, realizing actually, hang on, that's like thieving, and I shouldn't have taken it. And so I'd put it on the top of my car. And then I was going, this is the sort of thing where you're reciting because you only remember it because you know how quickly these things fade. I remember putting it on top of my car and then for some reason leaving my car and my car sort of rolling out and then being vaguely annoyed of not knowing where my car would have gone, because clearly cars drive by themselves, but not as well as when people are in them, which was an interesting concept because it wasn't that cars couldn't drive themselves. They could, but they don't always go where they're meant to go. Sort of like a more errant sat nav. So I was a little upset that I didn't know actually where it was. And then I had the family who'd actually made it had come around my house and were talking to someone who was there, and I can't remember. And that was intensely awkward because they might know that I was the one who stole it, despite having to try and take it back, which I incidentally, through the power of dreams, I had replaced it near some bins near the site, because obviously I couldn't go too close to the site because I'd be noticed and I'd be in trouble. I was still feeling very guilty about it afterwards, and I was hiding in my house upstairs, hoping that they wouldn't. And then one of the children was using one of the ladders to scale and look through the windows. Just actually, I wasn't even sure if it was them child or the children next door. I don't know why. It's a dream. But you asked me what I've done about Doctor Who this weekend. Nothing. But I have just had that dream.
Okay. The reason I asked... which was supposed
you
to be just a minor,
get that
minor
sort of thing on podcasts. You don't get dreams. You don't get dreams that have just been had of the moment that are contextual to the podcast.
No, you don't. You're absolutely right. And, round of applause for James McLean's dream. Round of applause. Woo! Thank you for sharing your dream with us, James. Next week on the podcast, we'll have Derek Okora, who will be discussing dead people with us.
I see.
I'm only teasing. The reason I asked what we've been doing at the weekend was because I know that Brian isn't cosplaying at the moment.
Right.
And there's this cosplay feature in Doctor Who magazine with lots of people dressed as the Doctor because it's a cosplay feature. But none of them are the 10th Doctor.
Really?
Apart from, well, is there a 10th Doctor in there? I think there's an attempt at a 10th Doctor, but he's got a beard, so he doesn't count. There's really
the 10th Doctor.
Oh, no, there's another 10th Doctor there, but he's not as good as Brian, because Brian's obviously Brian. He looks very good, though. He's called Jesse, and he lives in France. The only other 10th Doctor is a picture of David Tennant.
There is a 10th Doctor there. He does look good.
He looks
Brian.
Okay.
This whole segment is about fawning for Brian, and you're upset that I upset your segment with an interesting, original, innovative section upon a dream that I have had, so no one else has ever had.
No,
but
no,
really,
you
no. You just wanted to get down to fawning on Brian's cosplay.
No, I wanted to talk about Doctor Who magazine. I wanted to talk about Doctor Who magazine because, as well as there being a cosplay feature that doesn't feature Brian because Brian didn't know about it and no one told him and no one sent any pictures of Brian.
I knew about it. I didn't submit a picture for myself.
That's fine. Okay, you don't have to justify it.
His segment's crumbling. Carry on.
It's just pathetic, isn't it? There's an interview with David Warner.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, it's quite a good interview with David Waller where he talks about various things he's done in his career, and he talks about the Doctor Who Unbound, and he talks about Cold War. So it's kind of like my favourite feature. There's the ongoing thing about BBC Worldwide's video and DVD thing, which I think is up to its third or fourth part. But you don't see interviews with David Warner very often, so this is a good interview. So if you are someone who doesn't usually buy Doctor Who magazine, if you can borrow a copy, or if you even buy a copy, if you like David Warner that much, it's certainly worth getting your holds on. It's a good chat. And it talks about the Star Wars, the Star Trek films and episodes he was in, and Tron. There's mentions of working with, there's Time After Time with Malcolm McDowell. There's The Omen, obviously, with Patrick Troughton and Gregory Peck. So, it's a good read. I like David Warner. I like his Doctor as well. I think he did a good job there. So, that's my pick of Doctor Who magazine for you, anyway. Yeah, this has to be possibly the most free-form podcast we've ever done. We've started off with a completely different introduction. Then we've talked about John Pertwee. Then we kind of got over the fact that James isn't here, and we've kind of riffed on River Song and stuff. And then James turns up completely unannounced, having escaped his bizarro dream. Which can only have been brought on by
very true.
Can only have been brought on by lunchtime drinking, and then that. So yeah, if you're feeling a little bit of a podcast disjoint, dear listener, you're not the only one because so are we. I think it's time we got onto our recommendations. Is there anyone who would like to go first on this week's regular thing that we do every week and therefore are prepared for recommendations? Shall I go first?
Last week, Brian.
Sure.
Shall I go first?
Knock yourself out. There you go. James, we have control again.
Absolutely. Recommendations are now over.
Yes, they are null and
void. We'll talk
about
something far more interesting for the last 10 minutes.
So, had any good dreams lately?
You know, funny you should say
none
that.
None that I can repeat on air. Well, listen, we don't necessarily have to do a recommendation, but I really want to go and see Terminator.
Good for you.
You recommend it.
Well, I can't recommend it because I haven't seen it yet. But there I really want to go and see it. But what I've discovered is it's not out here yet. I think it's not out there either, is it, Brian? I don't think yet.
Oh, I have no idea.
I think it's out in Turkey already. Or that might have been... Someone said on Casterbus on the comments page that they'd seen it in Turkey. Or whether or not that's just a pirate thing going on, I don't know. What I have found is it's quite difficult to book tickets for it and for next weekend. The two main cinema chains here in the UK, Cineworld and Showcase, only have single screenings on Saturday nights, which seems utterly bonkers to me in my two local cinemas. So I don't know what that's all about. Did you guys fancy Terminator Genesis or not?
Not me.
No?
Not really, no. No? It's not. I'm a bit tired of the franchise. It's sort of like it's sort of like someone who you've quite liked, but there's the door and they're about to leave, and they leave. Mm-hmm. But just before you can get around to do something else, they come back in again. And then they make a big thing about leaving, and they go, and they come back in again. And you get to the point where you feel there's never going to be a time when they just leave the fucking room.
Yeah.
And that's the problem I find with Terminator Genesis, is that you keep perpetuating this. It's over. Oh, no, it's back again. It's over.
But is it the problem with Terminator Genesis, or is it the problem with just Hollywood full stop? Because there's two films I'm interested in this year. That's one of them. The other one is Episode 7.
Star Wars.
Yeah. Which I feel, as long as that's better than The Phantom Menace, which I think most people with brains, that's a very rude thing to say. I think most people, generally, most people, not just fans, but most people would agree is the best. I know it's not particularly adult. I know it's got some quirky crap in it. But in terms of a movie, in terms of a cinematic experience, I think that is the best of the three prequels. As long as Episode 7 is better than that, then I think that... I'm not expecting too much from Episode 7. I just want to have a good Star Wars-flavoured time at the cinema, which is... I don't think you get with Attack of the Clones or...
Yeah.
Oh, God,
I'm with you on that. Yeah. I just want to go and enjoy a film in some way, somehow. And like you said, those other three definitely were not that.
No, yeah. So, and
they had parts, though. That's the sad thing. They had parts that were good, or even a character or two that were good. Like, I still think Darth Maul was a good character. And I think if they were wise, they would have realized the whole Clone Wars was about cloning. And they could have brought him back and made him like this really massive villain for the next couple of stories. But instead, they just made some lame choices.
Hmm. I think it's interesting as well.
Yeah, go on.
Well, I was going to say, I think there's a lot of this. There's a lot of fans wanted the movies to be more like the spin-off novels, you know, the in tone and that. And I think and the video games as well. And I think the movies were. I think they were too heavily influenced by video games and spin-off novels. In terms of tone and content,
I think that's boring.
Where they went wrong.
I mean, you can justify it anyway. I mean, the first film made the mistake is that you had no character dynamics. You had exactly the same character duplicated twice as your two main heroes, with nothing to fence off.
Mm-hmm.
So there was nothing to pull you in. Second movie had a terrible, poorly cast lead actor in a dialogue which had no chemistry at all. You couldn't get behind him at all. So that was irritating. And by the third movie, which I think is actually probably the best, most enjoyable of the three, you have the issue that it starts to feel it's now too close to the original films, and it's starting to conflict with its sort of rationale doesn't feel quite on track. And while Anakin is a lot better, you have this horrible mixture of trying just to throw everything at the screen and seeing what sticks. So by the time you get to the great finale of lightsaber battles, you've already had a lightsaber with a guy with six of them. And it's like, you've played this card too many times in this movie for me to care at the end. So the whole construct of movie seems to be missing. So
they also had the issue. Sorry.
That was it.
I was going to say they also had the issue, too, where they tried to over-explain things. You know, they had to explain the Force, which was just a bad issue.
Yeah.
They had to have Darth Vader being from Tatooine, creating C-3PO and having R2-D2 somehow in his life and so on. And everybody was just connected. They just did too many things which just didn't gel or make sense. And, you know, when you were watching it, it seemed like a checklist of things that they just felt they needed to do rather than he had this story in his head, as Lucas said he did since creating the original three movies. And you just don't get a sense of that, because if that was true, I don't think half of those things would have happened.
Story in his head, didn't he? And, you know, it's all been documented plenty of times, you know, in the late 80s and early 90s, that he had a story in his head that he wanted to tell and then decided that he couldn't tell that bit, he had to tell another bit. But, you know, all the names were different, situations were different. It's just... there is a kind of a theme to the story that he wanted to tell. It wasn't as detailed as he made out in you know, the promotional and the DVD extras and stuff for Phantom Menace and the other two. Nothing like it.
Yeah.
It seems sort of vaguely like a lie, doesn't it? I mean, given that there was a lot of talk initially in the earlier, if I remember, in the earlier ideas for Star Wars, was that there was never this whole thing that Luke would be descended from Darth Vader. In fact, the characters weren't even that well made Genesis yet. They were just amalgamates of various other things.
Yeah,
and you even feel it within Star Wars that there was no intention of that until Empire Strikes Back. So you kind of feel, and then of course you've also got the structure of the earlier drafts where Cloud City is in Star Wars. And so, yeah, there's little bits and bobs I imagine that he would like to have used. And the whole point of Star Wars being episode 4 is, again, just simply because he wanted to show, and as we know, yes, it wasn't shown as episode 4 in the cinema, but the whole idea of being in media ray and in the middle of all this, this stuff was just a sort of homage to the Flash Gordon thing, which Star Wars was homaging.
Yeah.
It's a chapter of a large epic. But there's this horrible thing that all, and we can go back to Stephen Moffat as well, especially he does this, likes to revise retrospectively his plans and say, well, you know, even though you know that those weren't his plans at the time, because he's got a certain continuity, suddenly that continuity now informs his how he approached it, and suddenly he structured in which you know wasn't meant to be structured in. And you get this so often with writers. Lucas is obviously a major one for it. And suddenly history is revised in light of what has been done rather than what was being planned at the time.
So
and that's what Star Wars feel. I agree with Brian, it becomes a checklist, and doesn't even become a very good checklist. That's the problem. You still end up with one of the very last scenes leaves the audience going, well, how comes Obi-Wan Kenobi doesn't recognize R2-D2 then?
Yeah.
That's like the penultimate scene. Yeah, you wipe C-3PO, but what's about the problem with Obi-Wan? You've not got to that one yet. And you don't.
I mean, said that the third one was like the best of the three, you know, kind of thing and feel. Do you know I fell asleep during the big battle in the lava pit?
Well, that's it, because you'd already seen the same sort of thing done. It was no crescendo to it.
There's too much lightsaber, is what you're saying.
Yeah, there's too much lightsaber, and probably not enough characterization or understanding the characterization. It's sort of labored on the idea that the Force takes you over, so we don't really have to show any particular transition for Anakin. He can just change like a zombie. It's probably very suitable in today's market, but there's no
satisfying.
Yeah, I was trying to say satisfaction, and then I realized that's not a word. That's why I can't say it, because it doesn't exist.
Satisfaction.
Satisfaction, far more conventional. Yes, exactly.
Yes.
So yeah, with Terminator, in a sense, I'd be interested in it because it is, at least in a slightly lazy way, but in perhaps a better way than any, it's sort of rebooting the whole thing blatantly and therefore creating its new story and thus possibly its new franchise by just going back and just totally annihilating the past in the same way that Star Trek tried to do. But at the same time, you kind of feel like, well, you're annihilating the past because you're hoping to make money from this rather than...
Are we back to Terminator now? Or...
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
No, I like the fact that they've released what seems like a major spoiler. Leads me to think that there's an even bigger twist, which I'm quite intrigued by. Obviously, I'd be hugely disappointed if there is no bigger twist.
You will
but
be,
But
yeah.
I also think that it's been really well cast as well, so... That's mainly why I wanted to see it, really, because I was impressed by the casting.
Well, I think I'd want to see it for the
Whereas
same reason
last time,
I wanted to see. Yeah.
Last time I was kind of interested by the casting, and the time before that I was completely nonplussed by the casting with Terminator 3. Well, obviously Terminator 3 is a better film than Terminator... I was going to call it Terminator Resurrection then, because I'm getting confused with the aliens. What's the fourth Terminator film
Salvation.
Called? Salvation, thank you, yeah.
And then you've got the Terminator TV series, which had a good Terminator. Summer Glau was really good in that, but the rest of the story didn't gel. I think it's a shame that they've not sort of brought her into the main canon, since she's quite well at it. But I mean, that's the thing. I'd be watching Terminator Genesis because there's certain fascinations in the same way it's interesting watching the Star Wars thing. This is the interesting thing with adaptations of franchises that we've got now, is the question of why people are going to watch them. Are they going to watch them because they're still interested in the concept, or are they going to watch them because they're using it to sort of reconcile the past? I want to see Han Solo as an old Han Solo because I want to reconcile that with my experience as a kid watching Han Solo as a young person, and then seeing how that letting my brain sort of work through that process. And this is an older version of Han Solo. Han Solo, I remember when I was a kid. There's so many layers to that sort of thing. And it's the same with Terminator. You've now got really old Arnie. It's like, you know, this is a character who's been going now for 30 years or so. You know, I'm trying to reconcile this. And that is what a lot of audiences do. But once they get past that, they're bored and done with it, and they don't really want to go and see the next film unless that film has really interested them. And I think that is a big problem at the moment, is that studios are not realizing that a lot of people watch these films for that initial nostalgia and reconciliation of elements, not because they're interested in seeing another six of them. But they'll work it out soon enough.
Hmm. I was watching someone, this is only tangentially related, someone sent me a link to a YouTube video, which I'll share in the show notes, in which they discuss and provide demonstrative clips the difference between movies 10 years ago and the movies now, where there is a lot of CGI now compared to, say, 10 years ago, where the processing power wasn't available for a lot of CGI, so the majority of the CGI was on the principal characters rather than sort of background stuff. And basically saying that we're not connecting with movies in the right way, as we used to, because of this overuse of CGI for backgrounds.
I saw that, and I'm not totally convinced by it. It did smell a little bit of the same old argument that films are not as good as they used to be, which is perpetuated since the 50s. And so I'm a little wary of that. I can sort of understand what he means. There is an interesting change, but there isn't, because people still question what they already see as being effects in a sort of way. They don't just assume on it. It works on the presumption that everyone sees effects now as being totally seamless. The spectacle is seamless.
Yeah.
And it's not. People still find faults in it. And even his example of the two Hulks, I mean, I understand his logic to why he preferred the scene with the previous Hulk in Hulk. And you have to watch the video to understand this, even though the Hulk's not very well. But because the Hulk wasn't perfectly done, and there was a lot of irritation by a lot of people over his, if you look in that scene at his shorts that he's wearing and the poor seaming on that, which I never noticed, but some people did. There's always people complaining about it. So is it really that, or is it just that maybe you've become so saturated with the same sort of films, that the blockbuster model that, you know, has been sort of perpetuated since Jaws, that you sort of lose that ability to sort of feel the thrill anymore? Is it more that than anything? I don't know. I'm just always very wary of those sort of things, which end up sort of being films were better when I was younger arguments. And here is why, even if the argument seems quite credible.
Well, the reason I bring it up is because was Avatar, which really stood out to me. Because I remember when I went to see Avatar in the cinema, I remember feeling the unreality of it with the 3D glasses on. I know this isn't accurate because I suspect this isn't accurate because I haven't rewatched it in 3D, but I've seen it in 2D since. But I felt watching it that everything was in focus. Everything was in focus. Which can't have been the case because it was in 3D, obviously. So there has to be an unfocusing for the 3D 3D illusion. But I just felt I was particularly touched by the unreality of it, which totally broke my connection with the film whilst watching it. And the sensation that I was watching Pocahontas again.
But that's it. But even then, it goes the other way around, like with The Hobbit, when that was in 3D and it was done with a higher frame rate. People were complaining that they lost the spectacle because the effect made it look too real. It made it look too non-fantasy, so therefore they fell out of the ability to actually enjoy it. You think, well,
I
surely...
I can't comment on that because I haven't seen The Hobbit.
I slept through it.
Did you?
He slept through it. But
yeah,
it
oddly enough, I woke up for the Sylvester McCoy bits. Don't know how I did that because nobody woke me up. I just happened to do it. But that was cool. I will say on the whole CGI thing. Yeah, well, you know, it put me to sleep. So what can I say? Cool. On the CGI thing, I do think that CGI for, and I said this before, I think for things like creatures and people, dinosaurs and monsters and so on, sometimes it can be impressive and sometimes it just looks like CGI. And when it looks like CGI, it takes me right out of it. CGI for things like buildings and landscapes and things, half the things that we see in movies that we don't even realize are actually CGI. Clearly they're done well. You can get bad ones on that as well. If it's a bad TV production or even a low budget film, but generally films do a good job with landscapes and settings. But it's funny because I want to say I've noticed this and I think it's a very strange thing, but did you ever see a TV commercial where, you know, they'll animate a tiger doing something that it shouldn't do or being in a setting that it shouldn't be in, but it's clearly a CGI tiger because of the things they're having to do, maybe driving a car or something like that, I don't know, but it looks like a tiger. It looks incredible. And then you get to a big budget, huge blockbuster movie that also has a CGI tiger that you look at it and it just looks CGI. The fur looks fake. They're trying to make it blow in the wind and it looks like it's all airbrushed on and it looks ridiculous. Why is it that a commercial can do something better than a movie can is what I've been trying to figure out, because I've seen this a lot lately on various different commercials or various different little TV projects or something versus some big blockbuster movies, which, like I said, just took me right out of the moment.
Budgets.
Time as well, I imagine, is another factor.
Yeah, but you'd think a bigger budget would give you better effects.
Depends on the time you've got to create all the effects. I mean, one of the biggest problems with films is that they often are running to a time.
There's a production aspect to I suspect, and you'll be able to set me straight on this, I suspect there's quite a similarity with video game production with movie production in this respect.
Well, yeah. I suppose the only argument with video production is it's a lot cheaper in the sense that you don't have to do the shooting as per se, unless it's a particular sort of game. But yeah, you're set to a time period with a set budget and things go over. I imagine a lot of it is down to the fact, I mean, it'll be interesting to see whether Star Trek will make its release, in July next year. I mean, they're only now going into shooting, which is it's going to be tight, if that is true. So yeah, when you've got certain time frames where you're told you've got to get it done by, I imagine that's going to affect how well you can do everything. And then, as you say, whether the budget and how the budget is allocated is another matter, isn't it, I suppose? But I mean, it's just a funny argument, isn't it, when, I don't know. I mean, by that sort of argument, you should find it harder to enjoy. I'm trying to think of a Doctor Who episode of late, which was high CG or had a high effects quota. And there's been a few.
Day of the Doctor?
Or Day of the Doctor.
Oh, no, Time Heist's a good one. No, Time Heist's very good because that's got that huge CGI.
That should be harder to actually be impressed and enjoy than watching an episode of Attack of the Cybermen or, you know, The Keys of Marinus, which I love personally. But the point being is that I don't think really, I kind of think the argument of effects is not really the issue here. I think the issue, a lot of it is repetition and structure. And as Brian has perhaps in a way pointed out, duration as well. These things sort of makes film a lot less exciting and because it becomes a lot less of a spectacle. I think saturation is a factor that you do get used to effects being so good. So therefore the effects become less special and because they become less quantifiable, if you can see something which is is effect and you can be impressed by it, that can sometimes give you a greater interest than an effect that you don't understand how it's done or you don't even notice, or it becomes so seamless you've given up trying to work it out. You know what I mean? I mean, I used to like watching things like Red Dwarf or even Doctor Who and sort of saying, yeah, I can see sort of probably how they did that and that works. But now I can't even guess how they're doing it. I mean, I was watching Thunderbirds Argo, you know, and I didn't know which bits of that were. The model bits in it, I wasn't actually definitely sure they weren't just CG elements with, you know, very good mapping now. that give a real feeling of it looking like miniatures. You know, I wasn't sure. But I don't know. I think basically the video just sort of reminds me that we're all just grumpy old bastards who just grumble about whatever it is. There's too much effects or not enough effects.
I think with science fiction, that there has to be... I feel that it works better, right, when the... Ironically, when the CGI isn't too heavy, basically.
I think so.
I think
or when
then,
CGI looking, is diverse.
When the CGI is diverse, or when it doesn't impede, or doesn't interrupt, when it doesn't take you out of it, when it's just there to enhance rather than to take over.
Well, it's like Superman, Man of Steel. I was bored for the last 20 minutes. And not because it didn't look good or it wasn't high action. It was just simply, you know, spectacle by definition has to be something that impresses, and anything that goes on for a duration we become accustomed to. So it becomes, there is a downward curve to how much it impresses us. As we've said before, that's how people can do surgery and not be throwing up every time, because you acclimatize. And you acclimatize to spectacle. So you've got to keep spectacle fairly diverse. So to have Superman smashing through buildings for 25 minutes, the audience, most of the audience will get used to it and lose interest. It'll become normal. It loses that spectacle. So you've got to keep shaking it up. Yeah. So I think you're right. You either diverse or you pocket it. So people are constantly awake. They're reminded. And I think those are the sort of best ways of doing it. And I wish I could think of any good examples of it, but of course I can't.
Well, for me, the most memorable and impressive sci-fi movies I've seen in the last 5-10 years are probably Moon, Oblivion, and Looper. Or is it Loopers? Whichever.
Loopers,
and I think I think they all work well because they're grounded in a recognisable world, and there is no over-reliance on the CGI. It's there,
well,
but they don't over-rely
Dread.
On it.
Dread is a very good example.
Dread is
has
Dread,
to be set in the future.
Yeah.
And yet, at the same time, you don't feel it's over-reliant. And it does play for spectacle in its art form with its slow-mo, which is...
Yeah, but it's more Sam Peckinpah, isn't it, than James Cameron. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it actually works within the film, but it doesn't become the norm of the film. So I think that's a good one. Okay. I used to think the first X-Files movie was a very good example of CG, where the CG was very minimalistic and it was there just to smooth over the cracks and not sort of take you away from what was going on. And I liked that was when CG was really starting to try and find its place. And I kind of liked that place where it wasn't being used to constantly try and sort of say, hey, look what we can do. It was sort of trying to say, hey, look at the crack you can't see anymore. And that was kind of nice.
That's really the best usage of it. I mean, you know, you can say that certain like sci-fi film settings set on alien worlds are going to need a heck of a lot more to kind of dress their setting. And I can get that. But going back to the new Star Wars movies for a second, there were too many times where the actors were on completely green screen sets, sitting on blocks, sitting on using green tables and so on. But if you build an impressive set, for the most part, even if you build 2/3 of a set or even 1/3 of a set and you do the rest CGI, the best CGI is when it's seamless and you can't see that the rest of that set was made digitally. And there's a lot of movies and TV shows that do that, where when you watch the making of and you see the scenes and you're like, you know, the ones that you can see in the making of where you sit there and you say, holy crap, I didn't know that thing was CGI. That's the most impressive. And they're getting better at that. But it should always be kind of an aid to the storytelling and not the thing that you're trying to impress people with. That's the best way to use it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Do you know, we're going to have to leave the podcast there on that very interesting and quite final note from Brian, because we are cracking over. We just hit over with an hour and 5 minutes, so we are pushing for time there. So no recommendations this week other than... We suggest you go and see if you can go and see Terminator. And then when I mention it next podcast, Terminator Genesis, we can have a bit of talk about that in the comments after the podcast next week. So that's the end of this week. We'll be back next time. Until then, it's goodbye from us.
The void beyond the mind. the empty space that circles time. I see where others stumble blind to seek a truth they never find. Eternal wisdom is my guide. I